Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the works of Thomas Harris. I'm Cooper, and I have with me...
Hey, it's Miko.
And this is Ophelia.
And we are drinking a Tempranillo Sangiovese tonight, which is from Cooper's Hawk, our favorite restaurant and winery.
So far.
Most of.
No. I think restaurant and winery, we're going to have to go with Hitching Post.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Well, our favorite Illinois restaurant and winery.
Right.
So tonight we're talking about episode 208, which is...
Sul Zakana.
Which is a palate cleanser. And in the last episode we talked about how that storyline had finished.
Yep.
And now we're starting something new.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not completely starting something new yet.
No.
But I want to jump right in... to that. We meet a new character.
Yes.
In this episode.
Most certainly.
Margot. And her brother. Her unnamed brother.
New, like you don't know.
I was going to say new if you haven't seen
if you've only seen the movie Hannibal, Margot is not a character in Hannibal.
Ah.
That's true.
Margot is not even mentioned in Hannibal. You've read the book Hannibal, though, you know exactly who Margot's brother is with the eels and the martinis made of tears.
Martinis of tears. Yes. Oh, my God. Is there a Bond villain?
I knew instantaneously who it was because I'd read the book.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything about that. I don't actually think I ever saw
Hannibal. Tiny little gauze pad.
Yeah.
Like the tears. I mean, seriously.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's beautifully shot.
I mean, it is the most theatrically villainous character Thomas Harris could have possibly written.
Yes.
We're going to spoil this for you. Mason Verger, Hannibal's final victim is the brother.
I mean,
Hannibal's only victim that lived.
That lived.
Right.
We're not going to talk about what happens to Mason Verger because theoretically that's still in our future.
Exactly. Right. And it may not be in the future of this universe.
But when we hear you should have took the chocolate, there's only one person that can be.
Yes, that's right.
Exactly.
And I am so excited.
And it was sort of wonderfully theatrical because we didn't get to see him.
No. You see his ring.
But you see the martini.
Oh my God. It was like the bad guy in Inspector Gadget, the claw, where you just see the hand with the ring and the cat.
Very Blofeld.
Very Blofeld.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So Hannibal gets another patient.
Yeah.
In this episode,
which I don't know if it's like because Margot is not in the movie. If you've only seen Hannibal the movie, you don't know this, but in the book, Margot was Hannibal's.
Hannibal's patient.
At one point.
And we're introduced to her after this scene where she slammed up against the fish tank with the eels in it. She's at the window very theatrically.
Gazing.
With her eye
through the gauze
and the window, the wonderful...
The curtains.
The curtains that we adore.
That we all wish we had.
Mm-hmm.
But she, we talk about the fact that she's tried to kill her brother.
Yeah.
For something he did to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's very vague intentionally.
I love the gothic Lolita Wednesday Adam look she has.
They've gone a very interesting direction.
I'm glad I watched this twice. Because the first time, all I could do is look at what she was wearing.
Stare at the collar. Yeah. I remember you saying, the collar, like, that giant metal collar.
Giant metal collar, because she has a huge white collar, like
extra lapel.
And then inside of that is this wide silver sort of collar.
Choker type collar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she sort of has this very sort of tight tailored black suit with stitching.
Yes. And I love when they do the white stitching.
Oh, yeah. Her cuffs show through. Yes.
And her designer sling.
Sling.
Yes. The designer black sling.
You know, she's got the black sling. She's got that massive ring on it. I mean, it's like an Elizabeth Taylor type character. Just out of nowhere, just ostentatious and wealthy.
You can tell she's got a lot of money.
Yes.
And is used to just getting anything, you know, unusual things or very couture.
But I guess that's the other thing, though. She looks like she's got a lot of money, but it's an obscure, it's artistic, unusual costume.
Exactly. Yes.
She's not wearing what you would see on Fifth Avenue.
No.
Well, it's continuing this show's tradition of appropriating previous decades. Like, when we found Beverly Katz, we had Freddie in her little choker brooch thing that she was wearing that was very 90s-ish.
Yeah.
This feels very 80s-ish. She's got those shoulder pads.
Goth 80s.
It's very goth.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
I was just, possibly overthinking it, but wondering what that all meant. Mm-hmm. That she seemed collared.
Collared because of her current situation. Mm-hmm. And also, so this is coming from maybe the kinky geeks in us, but the collars in that one society where, now I couldn't remember.
It's the one where they keep linking
them. Yes. You're talking about the African mech guy.
No. This is a sci-fi alternate world lifestyle where they have slaves and they have the collars that get locked with the rings.
Oh.
You know what I'm talking about? So like your master would come by with, it's a collar like that, no seam.
Yeah.
It seems to have no locking mechanism. It's a solid thing and only the master with the ring can come by and unlock it.
Oh.
And when you see the collar and you see Mason's ring, it's all like, that's what it triggered in my mind. Oh. I'll have to look up the society.
Yeah, let's look.
But
look that up, because
it's an older sci-fi, almost like Isaac Asimov type of thing.
Oh, wow, okay.
Where the society is, the slaves have that solid band collar, and you can only be freed by that special key.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and it plays into this dynamic between her and her brother so well.
Oh, yeah.
So well.
That's pretty much what I was getting out of it, too, that, you know, this was some kind of collared, what they were trying to tell, someone who is, you know, kind of bound, you know, but it was so very interesting and so very different from, I mean, not that we haven't had unusual designs, because we've looked at Hannibal's, amazing suits for a season and a half. And he's been dressed stylish but unconventional.
And I have to agree with Cooper here, too, that it is very akin to the extravagance that we saw in Freddy Lounge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's on that vein, but it's dark.
Like Alana dresses like a normal person.
Yes.
Yes.
Very distinct, but like a person you'd see out in the street.
Yes. Exactly.
Freddie Margo are both this sort of hyper-real extravagance, just like Hannibal.
Yes.
Yes.
Because Hannibal is not
the finer
standard guy you'd see.
The finer things.
Sort of like an absurdist take on what...
Eccentric.
Very eccentric.
It's an eccentric need for the finer things.
Now, it is worth talking about that Margot's character in the book is very stereotypical in Thomas Harris's point of view. Very butch, very bodybuilder. She's trying to get married. She's trying to get her... she's trying to have a child
adoption,
so she can take on the verger wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was great immediately to see that they didn't go in that direction. They're going a completely different direction with Margot. Mm-hmm. And,
well, we still haven't seen the full dynamic between her and her brother yet.
No, very true. But in general, like her appearance.
Like right now she seems so femme.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
it seems true. It would be a complete 180.
Right.
If she became...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Because it's definite, in the way she's interpreted in the books is that she's interested in being masculine.
Right.
And
yeah.
Margot that she sees.
Her, and who's the security guard?
I
can't remember his name.
Barney.
Her and Barney bond.
They work out together.
They bond over working out together. Mm-hmm. And, she's also very, it almost seems like she's afraid of even her sexuality. Like, mm-hmm. she knows what she doesn't like, and she's kind of like, maybe it's okay to be interested in Barney, maybe it's not. And mm-hmm. then it's like she's suppressing that, and I think that has to do with the damage from her brother.
Yeah, it may
she's very confused about her sexuality.
A safety thing for her.
And it is safety. It's safety for her to be more asexual mm-hmm. than anything. So in the book, she's much less feminine than this particular version, which is totally vamp.
Oh, yeah.
Femme fatale going on, which was interesting, too. When I first heard her name being spoken, I'm like, wait, is that, what? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, I mean, we've seen so many other different renditions with Brian Fuller's recreation. It does seem like this would go right in with his, what was it, mixtape? Not mixtape,
Mashup. Mixtape works too.
Mixtape mashup of
exactly. You're not surprised that she doesn't look or act like the Margot in the book. You don't.
No.
And it's refreshing that it's not.
And it also seems like the Margot in the book is much farther away from the "I must eliminate my brother."
Yeah,
whereas this Margot is. Yeah. Starting off, well, with
we started
like
with
that.
That she tried to kill him and
exactly.
was unsuccessful.
Already unsuccessful,
and we don't know if that was before the scene we saw mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. after.
Right.
We just know it didn't work.
Right.
I really like the discussion where she could confess to having killed him,
mm-hmm.
and Hannibal wouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
But she can't tell him that she wants to try again.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannibal immediately throws out, if there's no one else to protect you, you have to protect yourself.
Yeah.
And
it would almost be more therapeutic.
Yes. Oh, I love that.
I love that
you killed
one.
Him.
Killed him.
It
and I was
more
just
therapeutic.
And the look on her face too, you see that connection, that glimmer, that little spark in her eye, like, oh, you might be somebody I really like.
You get me.
We should be friends.
Yes. Yeah, they're. I'm trying to. I wish I could remember. Because Hannibal does talk about in the books about his earlier sessions with her, but it's been a while since I've read the book, and I can't remember if any of that came up. About. I know that he does bring it up about how she was then is different than she is now.
Yeah.
Of how she was trying. So I think they're taking some cues from the initial. Therapeutic sessions
sure.
that are kind of touched on.
Well, one of the things I like, though, is Brian Fuller has commented on the fact that Thomas Harris is not known for his sensitivity towards the LGBT community. And so he consciously made the effort not to have Margot be in any way stereotypical the way Thomas Harris had written her. And, it's very much the way... James Gum is, it's very stereotypical and mm-hmm. it's almost CSI level.
Yeah.
Okay, there's this odd sexuality, so he's the villain.
Right. Also on the time that it was written, too.
Sure, very true.
And where Thomas Harris is coming from, generationally. Probably has no connection or understanding that you have to go deeper. It's something we're learning now.
Yeah.
It's kind of a recent eye opening.
And it's nice that we have this opportunity to go back and correct some of those viewpoints a little bit. I mean, it'll be very interesting to see what happens if we ever get to James Gum. to see how he'll be portrayed in this universe.
I agree with you with the Thomas Harris with James.
It's James Gum.
But with Margot, I always felt for her. There, he may have been off on some of the physical descriptions of Margot being stereotypical, but as far as her character development, I wanted her to succeed. He definitely wrote her in a way where I was like, I'm 100% behind this person, this character. She is not a bad guy. She is a good guy, and she needs, like, this is the victim I want to see, or the underdog I want to see prevail at the end.
Sure.
So he never, at least for me, in my opinion, and maybe it's actually more my connection to her, or my feeling towards females. I don't know. I always felt like he never did anything so grossly.
No, and I don't think in general Thomas Harris does anything grossly offensive with any of his characters that become the targets of criticism.
Yeah.
You know, James Gunn is obviously, it has nothing to do with his sexuality, he's doing.
No.
It has to do with a tremendously horrible relationship with family members and upbringing. Yes. And that's very traditional. What the criticism has always been is he is gay, so therefore, you know, it's almost an overblown criticism often. And it's just really nice to see what Brian Fuller's going to do with it.
And I think one thing that we could look forward to, because it is, you know, Brian Fuller, and it is a time where we're more, I guess, sensitive to things, is that you didn't necessarily have to portray Margot as femme to make it less, I guess, I'm air quoting, offensive, or not a problem, because there are plenty of, masculine oriented or more butch oriented. I mean, we've seen the whole spectrum of where you can be anything in between. You could be high femme, you could be high butch, you could be a boy one day, and you could be very girly the next. And I think that we could probably portray that a little less stereotypical and probably find someone who could really embody a more gender fluid character that could portray that or embody that in a way that is modern. Because there are real people out there who do that.
Yeah.
You know, who that is their identity.
Mm-hmm. Like Tilda Swinton.
Exactly. And lots of other people that we know,
that we know. In real life.
Exactly. IRL. Who embody all aspect of the gender spectrum and are happy in one side of it or go back and forth. And it is saying that we don't want to portray her as being that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily saying that we're saving it and making it less offensive, because I think with a director who understands the culture, probably could portray her that way in a far more real and sensitive light.
True.
It just seems like that he may be removing that entire part of her character that was extremely strong and important to her storyline in that book, because he has other uses for her.
Other plans.
Speaking of that, other plans. I mean, we don't officially know that this Margot is a lesbian. I mean,
we don't know at all.
Ophelia and I know, and so we've steered you into spoiler country.
Oh, see?
Yeah. I mean, it's really not spoiler country. Yeah. And her family thinks she's weird.
Yeah.
Well, she does talk about that, and she does mention. Does she mention lifestyle in the
Not at all. In this episode.
No. Okay. It's mostly about
just her family thinks she's weird.
But I love Catherine Isabel's pattern of speaking.
Yes.
She's understated and quiet and a little awkward and when she says they think I'm weird, it's, and she's always at the window.
Yes.
You know, she's in Jack's thoughtful window.
Yes. She's in the pensive window.
No, that's my thoughtful window.
Guests forget. And in that scene, we get Hannibal's line, "I'm much weirder than you will ever be."
Yes! Oh, I loved that line so much. Oh my God. I loved it.
And that, you know, he starts it out with every human being you will ever be. Yeah. And that every human being is capable of great cruelty.
Yes.
You know, it's a bonding moment between them. And also the sort of the whole thing where she's basically, her biggest frustration is that she knows her brother is the, like, far more weird and far more capable of insidious things.
And the family loves him.
The family loves him, and he gets, immediately forgiven for what he's done, and it becomes a show.
Right.
And everybody likes the
underdog. Everybody likes the...
Everyone loves the sinner redeemed.
Yes, there you go.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The talk shows and and you can tell it's happened time and time again.
This is Margot's life.
Yeah, that she's always the victim, and is always getting probably just tortured.
Yeah.
By her brother, but always a blind eye turned from her by her parents and her family, and then labeled that she's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that she's the one that is weird and unusual. You know, and fawning over the brother. So she's got lots
especially,
of issues.
Okay, if this is a wealthy family, which, again, we don't officially know, but we can make assumptions based on what we see, then the brother is the heir.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that is going to take over the fortune. He's the one that will produce a family. And I love how Hannibal just goads her.
Yeah.
You know, he talks about how she should cherish the anger because anger is an energizing emotion. Yes. And right at the end, just wait until you can get away with it or find someone to do it for you.
Oh, yes. And that, again, that look that they give each other, it's so much... said without saying it.
And so we only get three scenes with Margot in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them are Hannibal Margot scenes.
Yes.
And we instantly know a great deal about this character. Mm-hmm. We get to see Hannibal in a different light because we've never seen him with another patient.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to see him doing what he did to Will last season, which is pushing... to see what happens.
What happens, right.
And he's far more direct with Margot because he can be. Because Margot already has tried to kill her brother.
She's already on the road.
Yeah. She's already taken that first step.
She's theoretically a killer.
Yeah. A killer, yeah.
And so he can play the game with her that he was unable to officially play with Will all this time.
You can even tell the way she's represented, too, visually. Because Will came in with his neutrals and his earth tones.
And his goofy haircut.
Exactly.
And his unfortunate aftershave.
And then here comes Margot. Even in her second suit, she's got the really dark blood red shirt and the dark blood red lips. And the severe hair, and she's far more gothic, than Will was ever portrayed. So even the way they're representing her is that she has a dark side. She's not someone who's standing on the precipice
semblance of innocence. Her innocence has been taken.
Mm-hmm.
She is beyond that point, and now she's out for vengeance.
Yes, out for vengeance.
Which brings us back to the beginning. We open with snowy footprints.
What a great beginning.
And Jack and Will ice fishing. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful and to Jack see Jack and Will getting along.
Ice fishing. Again. Yes.
And Jack's completely on board. He's just like, well, why would we be doing this in winter? I'm here with my buddy.
Yeah.
But why are we outside?
But it's cold.
When I'm with Hannibal, we can sit in front of the fireplace and drink. Why do we need to be out here?
Well, that's why I say reluctantly ice fishing.
Yes.
Because he's like, I get it, the great outdoors.
Yes.
But why are we doing this in the winter?
Right.
And then everything that Will tells him about, the trout are harder to catch, when it's cold. And he's like, again, not a good argument for fishing in the winter.
It almost seemed like this was one of those, like, Aesop's fables.
Yeah. Right. Will specifically brought him ice fishing so he could tell him the story about how to catch a fish that is not interested in biting.
That isn't hungry. Catch a fish that isn't hungry. Yes. Oh my, this whole, it's loaded.
It is
so loaded. It's
setting
loaded
us
with,
up for what Will wants
it
to
is.
Do.
It is. And yeah, and Jack is on board. It's great because this is the first moment where you really feel that Jack trusts Will again.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that Jack believes Hannibal is the killer.
Yeah.
But he trusts Will.
Right.
And he knows Will is not going to just go out and do something again. Mm-hmm. He's going to prove it.
Right.
That's what Will is up for.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love that it's about creating a reality where only you and the fish exist.
Yeah.
And that's what he's going to try to do to Hannibal, is create a world where none of this matters. No one else is here. It's just you and me.
Just you and me, buddy.
Exactly. And you have to make the fish do something.
Well, I mean,
that it didn't want to do.
Right.
Where you force it to react
against its instinct.
Yes.
Against its instinct. Mm-hmm. Get it? Yeah. Well, I think we saw that exact thing happen when Will walks in and, you know, the comment is made, how are you going to take your life back? And Will says, I'd like to resume my therapy.
Yeah.
That right there, he's trying to catch the fish that isn't hungry.
Right.
And he's trying to create that world where it's just him and the fish.
And we see this in multiple discussions in this episode where Hannibal is so thrilled that Will has resumed his therapy.
Yes.
We don't know to what end Hannibal is thrilled. We just know for whatever reason, he's on board with this.
Well, I wonder if it's for him vindication. That all, like, oh.
Well, he is a good therapist.
Exactly.
As he tells Alana.
As he tells Alana. After their arty sexing.
Back in therapy. Yeah. After their sexing.
They're arty sexing.
It was the
arty sexing. Arty. It was very arty.
Arty sexy.
Yeah, sexy.
There.
Yeah.
I wrote dreamy.
Dream sequence.
It was just
the psychedelic music and everything in soft focus.
Before we get into the sexy time, I wanted to bring up the you hook 'em.
Yeah.
And
Will saying, I'm a good fisherman.
I'm
Jack.
A good
fisherman. Oh,
yes,
I'm
Jack.
A good fisherman, Jack. And he says, you know, you hook 'em. And I wanted him to say so badly, and I'll book 'em.
No.
But you hook 'em.
Well, he is jacking up the law.
Maybe jacking up the law.
But no,
maybe if he was Jodan Baker.
No, you hook him.
Jodan Baker would not say anything that clever.
That clever. No.
What did he say instead of book? I forgot. You hook him and I'll
land him.
Land him. Yeah. That's what it was. You hook him, I'll land him.
Which is basically
big fish.
Yeah.
It's very, very similar, but it doesn't fully follow. I mean, they definitely are staying in the vein of the fishing reference.
Right.
But we all know
that Will means
something else when he says, I'm a good fisherman.
Well, yeah. And Jack knows. That's why what I really
and this
like
this is something
here.
That's come up, you know, with his conversations with Abigail, the difference between being a hunter and a fisher. You know, the hunter hunts and the fisher lures. So this conversation has been, we've been led up to this.
Oh, yeah.
And Will realizes he's the bait here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
He is what's going to get Hannibal to slip up because Hannibal is so invested in his life.
He's going to get him to act outside of his instinct.
Indeed.
Yes.
But in the meantime, Hannibal's acting way inside his instinct.
True, true.
By cooking up.
The living fish that he holds.
I love he holds the knife up, looks at it, and then bam. And we're cooking. Yeah, and it's a great scene.
It's true. Keeping the fish fresh before you cook it is actually is the best way to get the flavor of the fish. Same thing with sushi. A lot of sushi chefs will keep live fish in their sushi shop before they actually, you know, make the fillets with it. It'll be fresh. Mm-hmm. It'll be swimming around in a tank, and then they pull it out, chop it up, put it on some rice. There you go.
And Will has provided this food.
It's my turn to provide the meat.
Nietzschean fish.
The fish,
their wild existence makes them
more flavorful.
Yeah.
And then he talks about how we are all Nietzschean fish.
Yeah, I have that. And I want to talk about the plating. So we see him cook it.
Yeah, I was about to say that what he was preparing in the kitchen
looked just totally different.
No way prepared me for what he was actually going to bring to the table. It was rather horrific.
The octopus?
Yeah, with the octopus tentacles.
I love octopus. I could eat octopus all day.
But they made it
look...
It did not look good.
Frightening.
Yeah, it looked frightening. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, usually...
And it was in that deep purples and blues.
Yeah.
And that is what it would be.
Sort of crowded on the tray with other things.
And the fish was, like, stuffed with
The fish was eating another fish.
Went through its mouth.
Yeah. It was very...
Everything about it was macabre.
It was macabre and almost, like, cannibalistic in the sea world.
Yes.
It's like cannibals on a plate.
On a plate, yeah.
With the fish eating another fish.
Yeah. And exactly. Put all that, and he explains it, and he puts it on their plate, and they're all like, this is delicious.
This is not the way trout that I catch is usually prepared.
This scene echoes scenes we've seen in the last few episodes, because they're talking again about how we need to put this behind us.
Yeah. And
now it's another person. Now it's Chilton. Mm-hmm. We need to put this behind us. We no longer believe these things. I hope providing the meat doesn't mean you still have doubts about what I serve.
I serve at my table.
And Jack answers it. No doubs.
No doubts, because what we see is all from the ocean.
What I also love is how... Hannibal tries to make it that we're like kind of like we're all in this together, and we have to stick together to get, you know, in many ways we need each other. We're the only ones that know what it feels like.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking in my mind,
because we were also very close to Chilton.
Because you've all been at my dinner table and eaten people. And when he was saying it is in a vegetable broth, I'm like, sure it is. Yeah. Sure, that's vegetable broth. Sure.
It's people stock.
People stock.
Cooked in people stock.
I thought it was very interesting that when Will delivers the line that he finds it delicious, he says it in a way where he's somewhat
shocked.
Yeah. Like, the way he says it and the sort of confused expression on his face, it's like he's almost
This fish is delicious, too.
Yeah, this fish is delicious.
And Hannibal said, what does he say? Something like, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Like, almost like... Mm-hmm.
Gazing at his wine glass. He's like, isn't it?
And
that playful little smile we all know that he does well. And
the smirk. Mm-hmm. The smirk.
So we had we talked about that sex scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we had a little...
Sheets.
Halana.
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 No, that's not good.
I don't like that.
Hannibal.
Hannibal.
I don't know. But it's exposition. The scene is exposition. Okay, you two silly people.
Ilanable.
Sorry, you started it. You really did. You started this.
I did.
So anyway, sex scene with sheets and face and half faces.
It's an excuse.
O faces.
Stop. Yeah. It's an excuse to have Alana in the episode.
Yeah, but we could have done that in a million other different ways.
No, but what we're doing is we're reminding you that Alana and Hannibal are a thing.
They could have just been laying in bed.
I'm not talking about the sex scene. I'm talking about I don't care about sex scene. The sex scene was arty and interesting.
The conversation that happened beyond it,
not so interesting.
Mm.
Except for Hannibal telling Alana that Will tried to kill him to protect her.
That part was very interesting. It was very important because he basically clarifies to her that it wasn't about going after like a revenge for Beverly Katz.
Right.
It was to prevent your death.
Yeah, he did this for you.
For you.
Which is an interesting tactic on Hannibal's
interesting.
Part.
He's all I can think of is this is where he's trying to get the threesome.
Now that's a season ender I would look forward to.
So really will that be your prediction? Can I put you on record?
I really want it.
A threesome, Hannibal, Alana, Will. Should we get Jack in there? Maybe they can be comforting him after.
It's still not the same. No. It's got to be the. Okay. It's got to be Hannibal.
Well, yeah. Hannibal touches Will's face and looks at him lovingly in this episode, and we'll get there.
We're not. Yeah, that's what they.
We'll get there.
We got first, a long way to go.
We got to talk about the turducken.
Goldmine. Sorry,
the turducken.
This is what the writers' room referred to the horse
episode.
Stuffed with the woman stuffed with the bird.
With the ice and bird. This is the turducken. Called the turducken.
So.
All right, I have to go back in my
phone. When you watch the Comic Con, you'll hear
which I'm not allowed to watch.
No, you're not allowed to watch the
spoiler.
They
We're
specifically close. Talk a lot about the finale.
So. We are getting close.
I'm going to have to binge watch that.
So you, Miko, when we first watched this, mentioned the fact that we open, after we see the dead horse and the doctor reopens the stitches and finds the woman, it's not so interesting because it doesn't feature any of our main characters. But when we come back from the credits, we see the horse's eye, and Hannibal is visible in the horse's eye. Almost in the hello way that he was in the
God's eye. Yeah, we see that image echoed.
Yes.
It'd be interesting to see if this comes up again, because I also felt that when Will looks into the cistern, also had that, that eye.
Anytime you're looking up into a privileged space, essentially.
Yeah, and that's very much the large black horse eye and the way he was sort of, looking down and reflected into it. And this brought us back to sort of the killer of the week stuff that we've been missing.
Yes. We have. I don't know that we've been missing it.
Well, you may not have been, but it's
been absent. No, have you been missing it?
Well,
you miss that?
Well, as I've said repeatedly, what I love about the killer of the week idea is the tableaus.
Sure.
Find the creative ideas that they come up with on how to kill people is fascinating. I look forward to that. It's like everything from the weird fungi mushroom thing to, I don't know, maybe it's the horror.
But we did get the tree man, and that was Hannibal.
Yes, that's right. That was something we hadn't seen in a while.
Right.
Though. We have seen other things. I mean, the Beverly Cats thing is also wonderfully mind-blowing, too. But I felt like we weren't quite...
We have been very Killer of the Week light this season. So we do have... Well, we have a very unique Killer of the Week this time, because the Killer of the Week isn't actually the perceived killer for most of the episode. I mean, it's a very interestingly set up episode, and we have some great guest performances in the episode, too. I love when they're looking at the woman, how Zeller is being all technical about what happened to
her. Yes, and Price
was like, she
it.
Was strangled. It was taking too long.
It's too wordy.
Too wordy.
Too wordy. Too
a
wordy.
Little, yeah. Yep, a I love that. Wordy. A little wordy.
Okay, I have a question, though.
Yeah.
Shoot.
Hannibal specifically told Jack he can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And
I thought it was interesting that he was there doing this, especially since Will is out of prison.
Yeah. Hannibal has to call Will back up to the majors, it seems like.
Yeah.
Because he says, this killer doesn't think like anyone else. You'll have to find someone else who doesn't think like anyone else.
Again, it winds up feeling like a device.
It does.
And we've experienced that here before, that we've ignored something that we have set as part of the universe. No, I can't do this anymore. Well, okay, well, we're going to say maybe he's over it.
Right.
For now, or maybe Jack as a friend, or without us seeing or knowing or sharing that part of the information. But it's only so that Hannibal can say that line.
Right.
That
as your psychiatrist, I advise you to bring Will back in.
Like, I know it's like, because I see what this is, but I don't know why he did it. I see what he did, but I don't know why he did it.
You're going to need Will.
You need someone. It doesn't even say Will. It says you need someone who can.
He may as well say, you will need someone else.
One, yes. I can't remember exactly what he says. It's something like, you need some. This is someone.
Someone who doesn't think like anyone else.
You need to find someyone who doesn't think like anyone. And it's like, I wonder who that's going to be.
He does have the nice moment, though, where he talks about how the horse is a chrysalis. And we get the Silence of the Lambs imagery there. Right.
We talk about how beasts of burdens are sacred. There's a lot in here.
Because there was a moment when they pulled that stuff out of her throat where I was waiting for it to be a death head.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Sarah Kraber is our victim here.
Yes.
And we're in the lab.
Can we clarify that she was just... if you've watched the episode, I'm sure that's why you're listening to this.
I hope you've watched the episode.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. But she was found sewn into the
horse. We didn't clarify that, no. Yeah. But yes, if you have not watched Hannibal, you should watch that before listening to our podcast.
Exactly.
We may be entertaining. Right. The show is better.
Exactly. Don't listen to us in lieu of watching the show.
No. Yeah, we are by far not the Cliff Notes version.
No, we do go over everything. Her throat is clogged with dirt.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is expelled in a burst of gas.
Yes, where they had like,
And here's where a little magic science comes into play.
Mm-hmm.
We'll take that and analyze it and figure out where she was buried.
Yes.
That's not actually too much magic.
Is there a database of dirt?
There's actually a database of plant material. They have solved a crime. Okay. You know, like the little helicopter things that fall? They've solved a crime based on a helicopter that was found in the back of a truck that had hair fibers and blood. And you know how it's really hard to convict without a body?
Yeah.
So they analyzed what was in the back of the truck. They found the helicopter, and through plant DNA, they found the tree. They had an area where they were searching, so they found a particular park that had planted this particular type of tree, and they were able to analyze the plant DNA from that key, what they call is a key that falls from the tree, from that key, analyzed that plant DNA and said, unequivocally, this plant DNA matches this tree. They dug up around that area and found the body.
I think, you know, there's...
It's one of the first cases where plants were used in forensics. There's an amazing amount of
knowledge in databases now, not just from the FBI, but they're accessing...
Botanists.
A lot of, botanists and things like that. I know they kind of touch on this in the books about how the FBI would go over to... they would go over to other offices and go to, like, museums and things like that.
Yeah.
So because they had more access to things like soil and animals and all different kinds of things and go, can you look this up in
well, environmentalists are always, environmental agencies are always collecting soil samples and water samples, which is why you would have those diatom databases. Right.
So it could have been collected for some other reason, but they can match database.
It. Yeah.
In this case, the soil samples were collected on private property. So it is unlikely to be public record what the soil is.
Not true. People do have their, I can speak from my mother's experience. They did have an environmental agency come in and collect samples from her house.
Huh?
Ground.
Maybe it's not magic science.
It's sort of conveniently easy.
It's convenient.
Because it happens very quickly.
I'm going to call it fancy pants science.
That's the part that's unrealistic, is how quickly they're able to match. Yeah, it does seem like
it
things.
All happens very this quickly would be and easily.
Months, if not a year to more to find these correlations.
It does seem to happen very quickly.
So what I'm saying is it's CSI magic.
Time frame is the magic.
It's fine, because again, these are such minuscule points in the episode.
True.
And really everything is metaphorical, so none of it really matters. It's all about the metaphor.
It's always interesting how much Price comes up with the most bizarre collection of information.
Yes, like about the bees.
Exactly. Bees. He does that in this episode, too.
Bees.
Whereas they're discussing Sarah on the table, he comes out with a whole bunch of, an odd, unusual mix of knowledge that is outside of his realm of... It's like he's somebody who just watches a hell of a lot of nature shows. And
I think that is him. He watches exclusively documentaries
and reads exclusively.
He probably reads detective novels. Yeah. I want to believe he reads detective novels.
Oh, I can believe that. Because he does. He comes up with a lot of stuff here. And then they wind up having the whole thing where...
She has a heartbeat?
Yeah, and then he has his hand on her chest and freaks out because he has... She has a heartbeat.
No right. pulse, but a yeah. heartbeat.
And they're like, she's got no pulse. And nobody, it takes him a while to convince them to touch her chest, right. which I found interesting. No. And then finally everyone was like, oh my God.
And then we get the really, really graphic chest cracking.
Yeah. I love this stuff. I really love this stuff because that is exactly what it is. It is accurate. That is what a chest opener does. You mm-hmm. do hear that crack.
And they use the autopsy Y cut.
Yes, they do.
Which is what they, you know, because sometimes on those TV shows, they just show a straight cut.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it's like an autopsy cut is that Y cut. Yeah.
I think it's also interesting that they're showing you the surgical way. Mm-hmm. So, from my experience in forensics, they would most likely use something like gardening shears to crack open a chest of somebody who is deceased.
But the thing is, there's something inside her.
There is evidence, and that's true.
And it may be alive.
Yeah. Which is why they probably go for the surgical equipment. Right. But it's not an atypical procedure. An autopsy to use a chest spreader that is made for a living patient who'd be on a surgical table.
Yeah, right.
That's not a typical, but I mean, we are talking about the FBI who's got more funding, et cetera, et cetera. But in a typical morgue, you're going to see somebody cracking those ribs much less daintily than the way they did in this. Right. They were being very careful to find out. And now, knowing other things from other shows, fantastical shows, where there's definitely CSI magic happening, it's kind of dangerous to open up a body that's got something beating in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Especially because we're dealing with these kind of high-profile murder cases. The first thing I would do would be like, everybody out of the room, you want to make sure there's no bomb in the chest. Sure.
Right.
But they don't even contemplate the threat that they're, yes, could they there's have something done... beating.
The FBI could be may have a magic scanner that checks for...
Well, then show us. Scanner.
We don't need to see that.
Oh, whatever.
Yeah.
But okay.
And then it's interesting that they cut her open and they don't do, like, any imaging or anything before.
Usually they would image a body before they would cut it
open. Well, maybe they did that.
Because you don't know what they could get out.
But could they not see that there was a bird?
Oh, you mean like...
They would x-ray and see a bird.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we find a bird. X-ray. Let's just get to the fact where we find a bird.
Well, it's
inside.
Not even that they find a bird. The bird literally, like, escapes.
Yeah.
And freaks everybody out.
Scares
I
them.
Loved the blood spatter when the bird shook off.
Oh, when the bird
off.
Shook off its feathers?
That was just wonderful.
Mm. Little extra gore there for you.
So, Will comes into the scene in slow-mo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it, like, needed
the slow
Sergio Leone score.
Yes, he does the slow walk into the stable.
And then
He looks at the files, and then he goes...
Into Pendulum.
And what I thought was really interesting, too, is that he went out of focus first. And then went into Pendulum.
I wanted to point out something artistic that occurred before we are in there with Zeller and Price and Jack. So we move from that comment where Alana and Hannibal are in bed, and you get this, they're resuming their sexy times, and you get this naked skin with the sheets being pulled back over them scene, and then the next thing you see is the sheet being pulled back
off of
away
her body.
From the victim's body. I thought that blend of the living, you know, sexuality, whatever craziness going on over here, is this immediately transitioned in, death.
Yes. Mm.
I thought that was a very interesting choice that they did before we get into that. Or we end that discussion of that scene. Carry on with Stable. Will and Stable, slow motion, Pendulum.
Oh, Will says he covered their eyes because there's comfort in darkness.
In darkness.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, very obviously, it's better to not know that Hannibal is the monster.
Mm-hmm.
There's comfort in darkness.
The wool over your eyes, so to speak. But I also like the idea that... when he's pointing this out, that is something that a caretaker would do for animals. They do that for birds to calm them down. You can do that for dogs who have anxiety going to the vet, cats, where you put a blanket over the carrier, and it's sort of that comfort in the darkness that they don't have to worry about what's going on, the traffic in the car, blah, blah, blah. So I felt like that was sort of the person who is doing this has concern for these animals.
Cares about the animal. Yeah, doesn't want to freak the animal.
But it was only for the animal, because he finishes that sentence with, but not for one of you.
Yes, right. That's true.
And it's the one that was killed.
Killed.
Yes. But then we find out that horse was sick because it gave birth to a dead
foal.
And was dying. Then Will talks about coffin births.
Yeah. Well, he also says, I took your life to give it back to you. I liked that word, or that phrasing. I took your life and tried to give it back to you.
Yeah.
And I like that Will knows that the killer, we're still assuming that they're looking at the killer, knew the horse and the woman.
Yeah.
So it's not just he knew the victim, it's he knew the horse specifically. And then we have this weird slow motion shot of a horse running up.
Yeah.
And it seems a little disconnected.
It did.
Yeah.
But it was nice.
I guess they were trying to give you something to look at while he was, you know, talking. So he does go over, you know, whoever did this knew the horse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, it's someone who, knows something about, being a veterinarian, but is not one. He has a lot to... information to impart here.
And then we get to meet this gentleman. Mm-hmm. Peter Bernardoni, played by Jeremy Davies, who I love Jeremy Davies from Lost.
Mm.
Played Faraday on Lost.
Oh, I love Daniel Faraday. Faraday with the physics reference.
Yeah.
Daniel Faraday.
And I get it. I get it. I'm with you.
Yeah.
But Jeremy Davies does this wonderfully fascinating performance.
Yeah.
The kind of performance that if you don't know Jeremy Davies, you think that this actor has some sort of speech impediment or developmental issue.
Well.
It's one of those things where you feel like they hired a guy because he is this. But Jeremy Davies he's so skinny and awkward and twitchy.
Uncomfortable and anxious.
Oh, just...
Oh, yeah.
When Jack and Will are sort of coming around the cages from each side... Just sort of like, we're going to be cool here.
Oh, and he's kind of like he's trying to figure out like a way out and sort of looking around furtively.
And just turns his back on them just so he doesn't have to look.
Mm. I love the way Will, even before much is said, he notices. It's almost like this understanding that this man is on the spectrum.
Yeah.
Like Will has this sort of, all right, I know how to approach this type of individual because I'm pretty close to being
Will sees
this
the mirror
type of
immediately.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And
he recognizes how he's damaged neurologically
because he got kicked by the horse.
When he can't look at the picture and
move at the same time.
At the same time.
That's an interesting thing, isn't it?
It is very.
And the way it's performed is so, and like the casual just flicking the picture back behind him. And I love how concerned he is about the bird.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
you know, he can help the bird.
But he can't.
That's why he can't help. He can't help the horse.
But
he can help the bird.
But he can help the bird.
I mean, he seems so. He doesn't even really comment on her.
No.
It's about the horse and about the bird. Mm. So who's got the bird? Because I can help the bird.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in
a room surrounded by animals.
A monkey. We got that shaky jitter cam that we used in the last season when Will was really going off.
That's always hard for me
when he looked at the picture of Sharon.
And it
really sort of gave you an idea that he has really a lot of difficulty.
And damage, yeah.
And a lot of neurological damage. That this is someone who struggles continually, you know, throughout their day. That everything from movement to everything visual to just basic thought is very difficult for him because of his injury.
At this point, I would have ruled him out.
Well, I think Will did. I mean, actually, Will did because they go outside. Mm-hmm. And Will says right away, he isn't the killer.
Yeah.
But he knows who it is.
He knows who it is.
Because basically he was like, if he did kill this person, then he, you know, he was like, he didn't do it on
He didn't
purpose.
Know he did it.
He didn't know he did it. He couldn't have, this isn't what, like a conscious killer.
But I feel like also his size and his stature, it's
everything
just like,
about
it. Would have been very hard for him
about
to
this
do
just
anything.
And also the fact
really
that he
difficult.
Couldn't coordinate visually and you
look
know,
and move at the same time. I feel like that's kind of important if you're trying
if you're going to choke someone to death.
Choke someone, gut a horse, and insert them.
Right. And especially
Well, no, I imagine he can do that stuff with animals. That's why he works with animals.
Okay, maybe.
Because he can like the horse he knew was dying.
True.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it so he wouldn't kill a horse.
No.
But the horse was already dying or dead. It may have been dead at that point.
Putting the horse down.
Yeah. So he may be able to look and touch and move with animals because he's not, you know, you got to assume that there's some damage emotional as well as physical.
Yeah.
So the emotional damage could be, well, he's being asked to look at a picture of a woman he knows is dead by authority figures.
And the stress increases. Because it is shown later on that he is capable of actually sewing somebody
into a horse. Authority figure in his life is extremely damaging to him.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of authority figures, we get a Will and Hannibal therapy scene.
Yes. Don't lie to me.
Yes.
That was
Isn't
wonderful.
That great that, I mean, Will is taking control of this. And he's not having any of Hannibal's dancing around bullshit.
Oh, no.
And
I can handle a sin of omission better than I can handle a lie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannibal tacitly agrees to it by not saying yes or no and just saying, will you return the courtesy?
Right.
And that's why he asks why you're back in therapy. And Will tells him, because he can't just talk to any psychiatrist about what's kicking around
right
in
my
head.
Yes, true. It's true.
I like that we're talking about rebirths here, because our obviously our symbolic death of the episode was reborn.
Mm-hmm. And Will, actually, in that therapy session, talks about the truth that he discovered about himself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes,
and I think he's
right.
awakening to what's happened with
the truth that doing
bad things
to bad people
makes
him feel good.
Makes him feel good.
And then we have the firecracker ending of the scene.
Firecracker.
I don't want to kill you anymore, Dr. Lecter.
now
that I finally
find
you interesting.
At this part, it was like, burn.
And that harkens back to episode one, when Will says, I don't find you that interesting.
Yes.
And Hannibal says, You will. I mean, that's the kind of thing the show does so well, is it reaches back and it pulls things back out for us and it shows them to us in a new light. Mm. And I absolutely adore that. So the dirt didn't take months.
No, it took
it
like
took
a day.
Maybe a day.
Yeah.
To lead them to 15 other bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dug out of the
icy ground.
Yeah.
Yes. You need to be a cop with a shovel that day.
Permafrost.
Man.
Bitch.
Yeah.
When, you know, how we were talking about last episode when Zeller was processing Chilton in such a dickish mood.
Instantly biased he was. Yeah.
Here, he apologizes to Will, but I like that Will just says, hey, the evidence was compelling.
Yeah, true.
Because, as Beverly Katz talked about, you interpret
the evidence.
And there was such overwhelming evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Zeller also does say, Beverly saw it, and we should have trusted her,
right.
And maybe
yes.
if we had, and he kind of gets that choked up. You know,
then
she would have trusted us and
right,
come to
she
us,
thought that we wouldn't
and she
look.
Wouldn't have been alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like there's that survivor's guilt that both Price and Zeller have. Like they
oh,
would have
definitely.
Rather
oh, yeah.
have been with her and been victims alongside her than have had to have processed her body
yes.
after.
And then thinking back, and okay, where did we go wrong? Where did we fail her?
Where did we make her not trust us?
Right.
Like, she was doing this on her own and could have been accompanied by someone in her final hours. Right. But we didn't believe her.
But they come to an agreement, a moment of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because I don't think Will holds grudges against anyone who put him there except for Hannibal Lecter. Yes. Because Hannibal is the only one that officially put him there.
Right. True. Everybody else is just responding in a way.
Maybe he's upset with Katie Purnell.
Maybe.
I hope so. There's a little grump to go around.
A little grump.
In the next scene with Will and Peter, there are two moments where Will dramatically misjudges Peter. Mm. I don't know if you've noticed this. First, he brings the bird to Peter, and he talks about how almost every society believed birds carried the souls to the afterlife. Mm-hmm. And Peter's like, "Do you think I think this bird is her soul?"
Yeah. Her soul, yeah.
And so that was number one, which it's really interesting to see Will misjudge because he doesn't do it often.
Right.
But then again, when he's talking about, is there a shadow? Yes. Someone only you can see? And he recognizes he's wrong first. Mm-hmm. Like, really quickly, when he then goes to someone you considered a friend.
Right.
Then it's all about Hannibal. Made you feel less.
And you saw what alone. He really is. Yeah,
until you saw what he really is. But isn't that interesting?
He will make sure no one will believe.
Yes.
I think that's kind of what happens there, is that he sees such a parallel in what evidence is presented there to his situation, that instead of trying to figure out exactly how it works for Peter, he gets caught up in how it works for him. Mm-hmm. That, oh, wait, we have something in common here. We have people who've been, and in a sense, it's
and not only that, much what's happening. But it's, we have something in common, but you're clearly more damaged than I am.
Yeah.
And your damage indicates that you believe things that I wouldn't believe, and that you have a voice telling you what to do, rather than an actual person. And that person is Clark Ingram, social worker, played by Chris Diamantopoulos.
Wow.
Something like that. Who has a smile and shark eyes.
Yeah.
Just black eyes. And
a little bit dead.
He just holds this smile. Mm-hmm. And this is valuable use of Alana.
Yeah.
Because she plays so well.
You know,
she flirts with him. She touches him.
Yeah.
She's trying to push him.
Oh, yeah. Everything, the tone in which she asks him things.
Yeah.
It's almost like, it's almost like the lure. She's trying to catch that fish that isn't hungry. He's hiding something, and he's trying to use this really slick veneer to hide his intention.
I did it because I like people. Society needs caring people.
Society needs psychotics too.
Yes.
Us on our toes. Yes. And all I can think of was like, oh, is that what makes Hannibal so hot to you?
Right.
Keeps you on your toes.
Well, I imagine he does.
Well, she has no idea.
Well, and he plays the, you asked how I feel.
I feel like I'd like to leave.
Yeah. He starts out very defensive, because he talks about, the first time he talks about how, you know, that, you know, he's being, he feels, when she asks him how he feels, the first thing he says is inconvenience.
Yes.
Because he's being detained, and she's like, well, you're not actually being detained, just interviewed.
This is just an interview, yeah.
Yeah, we're just talking here. I don't know where you know. And then
everybody be cool.
Then he responds to that, and she writes a note, and he's like, what are you writing down?
Yes.
Just
an observation.
If that wasn't like a psycho moment right
It was totally a psycho moment.
What are you writing down? And that's the thing. He is way obvious sociopath.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they could have gone a little more subtle with this. He didn't have to be so obvious. Yeah.
But even Hannibal says that his response is typical, but it could be resentment.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so, you know, they sort of tamper it a little bit by saying that, what you might be seeing here could be stereotypical sociopath, but it could be also him being very defensive. Because he's being accused of something sure. that, you know, he may think, you know, why am I the suspect?
Yeah.
So before we move on, I want your opinion. Okay. Is Will overplaying his hand? Because so. Will hits him with, Peter is being manipulated by a man in a position of trust. Mm-hmm. And I know what it's like to be pointing at a killer and have no one believe you. Is that playing for Jack? Is that reminding Jack? Or is that just is that just Will spiraling out a little bit too far?
Well, I think it touches him so a little too close mm-hmm. to his personal experience.
For sure.
And
we see that followed up right. later in the episode.
And he may trying to deal with his emotions with that and what's going on, especially since he sees it unfolding one way as this is the guy who's manipulating this poor, damaged person. Yet Hannibal is first to say, well, maybe that's not what we see. Maybe he, you know, it's just resentment. And doing what everybody was doing to Will is, oh, no, that's not, you're not seeing what's really there.
Right.
It's probably something else. And he's just like, oh, come on.
Hey, yeah.
You know, come on.
You know, in that
moment. It's
like
they're staring at you in the face.
Exactly. So he has to go, but I know what it's like to be poor, you know, and then to, which Jack replies, oh, but you were pointing, in the wrong direction.
When this is the question, then, is Jack saying that for Hannibal's benefit, or is he actually engaging with Will there?
I think it's the latter that you had mentioned earlier.
Actually engaged, actually feeling this.
Yes. I think so.
Yeah.
But how about Jack?
I think Jack is probably like...
Where's Jack at?
I think it's Jack's frustration yeah. in... That to him it's said and done.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because if the evidence, if it, you know.
He was able to close the book on Baltimore's most notorious serial killer.
Right.
He'd rather not have to reopen it.
Exactly.
Since
it was all laid out with the evidence in the house. And, okay. You know, and he swallowed that whole.
He would have to be playing devil's advocate at this point. And I don't see Jack doing
that. He's either really hiding a hand right now very skillfully. Or he was like, no, you want me to look at the evidence? I got all the evidence.
Yeah.
I have the guy that fits the profile.
Mm-hmm.
I have somebody, he does that in the previous episode where he lists all those things that unequivocally in his mind shows that he's been looking at the wrong person all along.
However, he did that with Will too.
But he's not realizing that right now because here the evidence is more...
For Chilton,
yeah, it's true. Where it was very vague with Will. A little bit more so.
Honestly, Will's a likable victim.
Yeah.
Right.
You get the Chilton sense that Jack never liked Chilton.
You want to believe that he would do these
Chilton
insidious
was like,
things.
Please let me help you regain memories for Miriam Lass. And Jack's like, no. Yeah. But Hannibal, you want to do it?
Sure. Yeah. Oh, and then, I mean, Chilton even says when he's at Will's house, he's like, oh, you know, you think, you know, if I'm running that I'm not going to look
you didn't
guilty.
Run.
You didn't run and you look pretty guilty. And he's like, oh, you know, I have a dead guy, you know, in my guest room.
Three
you
dead
coughed
guys.
Up an ear.
You just coughed up an ear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it is that the evidence in Will was just as minimal as we can kind of place you in these areas. And we have somebody who's missing.
But we don't.
Whereas, yeah, it was upped with Chilton.
Yeah.
It was blown up. You know, you have a body and several bodies and disemboweled FBI agents. He's covered in blood. You know, there wasn't any other way to look but at all this mounting evidence.
Well, curious then, this is not about this episode, but do we feel that Chilton was part of Hannibal's long game, or was Chilton an improvisation?
I think maybe not in a really long game, but I think he hated Chilton.
Well, he definitely
enough.
Hated Chilton. Because Chilton did create the copycat.
Yeah.
You know, well, not the copycat. Chilton created... Fake Chesapeake Ripper.
Fake Chesapeake, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The Chesapeake Ripper stand-in.
Yes.
So
right. So I think...
Well, the real Chesapeake Ripper.
That he was coming up with a backup plan.
Okay.
And Chilton was the backup plan.
And then it just fits so nicely.
Yes. Exactly.
With a bow.
All tied up with a bow.
Back to this case.
Yes.
Peter finds all his cages empty.
Yes.
Which...
Where... And all I kept going was, where are the animals?
I wonder that. Piled up dead. Where are the animals? I also wondered, where did Peter have to be?
What, that he wasn't
that
there?
That he could be gone long enough for all of his animals to be released.
I don't know. Maybe he had to go to the DMV or something. What appointment...
The DMV. Oh.
That would take his entire day.
It would take an entire day. True. I don't know. It's especially snowing.
if he can't do the post office
right before Christmas.
Very true.
That's a really long
time. It is Christmas time. Okay. He finds a dead horse.
Yes.
The one that kicked him. Mm. And when Ingram is playing with him about why he did it, you know, that you did it.
And he has the body.
I love how quickly he defends the horse.
Yeah, the horse.
She was just scared. Yeah. She didn't know what she was doing.
Mm-hmm. I think through this whole thing, and that was what was difficult, when Will was talking to Peter, and I had a hard time because of Peter's speech impediment and how softly they were speaking. I had a really hard time understanding everything he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
But it really seemed like Peter was a gentle soul.
Yeah.
And... True. That he just had a hard time. All he wanted to do was take care of the animals. Right. And everything from his experience with, you know, Sarah and the animals, it was, you know, all about what can I care for? What can sure. I, you know, take care of? And how he took care of all the animals and wanted to take care of the bird. And this sort of probably looked to Ingram like weakness. And yeah. It was something that he could... very easily manipulate, and almost the polar opposite of Ingram, who couldn't give a shit about anybody.
Right.
Was sort of that very cold sociopath, I can't connect with you.
You remember how we talked about Will and Hannibal's road trip at the end of last season?
Yeah.
I guess this is what their mix sounds like. Chamber music.
Chamber music.
And it's lovely.
Did Hannibal make a mixtape?
I bet Hannibal did. Make a mixtape for Will. It says Will and has a little heart on it over the eye.
It's Will's awesome mix.
Will's awesome mix.
With a heart over the eye.
And
wow, crack yourself.
I like that Will needs to be saved from who Hannibal perceives him to be. Because
yeah.
Will sees what Hannibal thinks he is. Mm-hmm. Even here, you know, Will knows Hannibal thinks he's a killer.
Mm-hmm.
And not just because he pointed a gun at him, mm-hmm. but because he has potential.
Right.
You know, just like he sees in Margot, potential.
Potential, yeah. And I find it interesting, because I believe this is like a revisitation of a previous conversation they've had, this whole idea of, you know, I'm alone in that darkness. And we've discussed, Alana has talked about how Will is, you know, in this darkness. He's in this dark place. And that they were all kept talking about he's in a dark place. Mm-hmm. But this time he says, I'm alone. And Hannibal's response to that is, I'm right beside
you. Yeah, you're not alone. Aww. I'm standing right beside you.
Exactly.
Which reminds me a lot of Jack's granite bedrock comment.
Yeah.
But it's weird because it also has that sinister thought. It's like, you're not alone, Will. I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm inside. You open the door and I'm inside.
I'm inside you. Wait, no.
Fan fiction.
And so Will and Hannibal walk in and find Peter sewing up a horse.
Yes.
Pretty incriminating.
Exactly.
And we have the incredibly banal line, is your social worker in that horse?
In that horse, yes.
And Peter just says, yes.
Yeah. Yes.
I love it so much. A
matter-of-fact conversation here. Mm-hmm. Very much so. I used to have a fear of hurting.
And the social worker helped Peter get over his fear of hurting anyone. By hurting the social worker.
Exactly.
We didn't mention, though, that when just before we cut away from the scene with Peter and Ingram, we do that jittery cam when he's looking at the hammer.
Yes.
And the hammer that was used to kill the horse.
To kill the horse.
And I...
A little foreshadowing there.
Peter... I mean, again, Jeremy Davies is just tremendous in this role. Mm-hmm. And when he says, I think he deserved to die, it's with such pain. Mm-hmm. But it's a recognition of a great truth, right, is that this man deserved to die. Yeah. But Will saying, you didn't deserve to kill him, mm-hmm, is... It's Will... I mean, obviously, again, this is metaphorical stuff. Will is recognizing that he didn't deserve to kill Hannibal.
Right.
He didn't deserve to have all this happen to him that would happen by killing Hannibal.
And it's interesting that a lot of these scenes seem to be about giving Will an opportunity to voice his feelings about Hannibal while Hannibal is right there in the room.
While he's right there.
Yeah, because, you know, as you know, what was done to you was cruelty for cruelty's sake.
Oh, what a great line.
I envy your hate.
Yeah.
It's like there's so much
that in this brought me back to that weird line, the feeling that does not yet have a name. The anticipation of feeling contempt. Yes. Which is still one of the weirdest lines in the entire series.
But sort of like that, you know, Peter has sort of not really made peace with what's happened, but can fully see it, mm-hmm, and has been able to deal with it.
And this is Will and Peter have left the stable.
Right.
And are just having a conversation because Will wants Peter to admit he killed them. Ingram.
Yeah.
He's going to try to get it out of him without having to worry about anything else.
They have that little conversation with, when Hannibal says it's an abnormal reaction to abnormal behavior is normal.
Is normal, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then, sure, he says, oh, you know, come with me. And he tries to get the information out of it, and they have that interesting conversation. But then there's also the revelation moment.
That Peter just wanted him to feel what it was like to suffocate.
To suffocate.
Yeah.
And that's where we get the rebirth of Ingram, starting with the fingers in the incision.
I actually wrote in all caps an exclamation point, he's not dead!
I'm not quite dead yet.
Can we talk about the most epic moment in the scene?
Yes.
Hannibal casually petting a lamb.
Yes!
And looking up and seeing Ingram covered in gore, yes, stand up, and Hannibal, for the first time in the entire fucking series, looks shocked.
He looks shocked, but I love what comes out of his mouth.
You might want to crawl back in here.
If you know what's good for you.
Yes.
Ah.
And then he sidesteps, and there's Will with the gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love
it. Hannibal is so curious about what's going to happen here.
It's almost a little comical. Awesome. Yeah. This part seemed a little comical because we've got the shtick with him petting a lamb. We've got the shtick with, you might want to crawl back in there. Yeah. I mean, that was...
I like that, though.
No, I'm not saying it's bad. It's a little broad for the show.
But we immediately take it back down.
Oh, yeah.
Because then when...
Serious happens.
You know, Hannibal wants to see Will take his spot, mm-hmm, but then at the same time he recognizes what damage it'll do to Will, so when he tries to talk Will out of it, mm-hmm, by won't feel like killing me,
right,
don't do it for him,
right,
if you're gonna do it for yourself.
And I found it so interesting, though, is that this guy gets to hear this entire conversation and about how Will is dealing with it, and Hannibal's dealing with this whole thing of, you know, oh, this isn't me that you're killing, it's somebody. And it's like, Ingram is sort of like he's covered.
It's like, what did I wander into here?
And he has this look on his face like, what the fuck is going on?
Okay, I thought I was the psychopath. Like, what is happening?
You guys need counseling.
When Hannibal takes the gun away.
Which, when Hannibal puts his hand in front of the firing pin. Yep.
Then there's this moment where he says that this is not, when he was talking about, like, do this for yourself, I kind of got that feeling where, remember when he had asked him earlier, how would you want to kill me with my bare hands? It almost felt like he was taking the gun away to be like, all right, well, if you're going to do this, go do it with your bare hands.
Interesting.
Like, that's how I kind of felt like he was like, okay, well, if you're going to do this, don't do it with a gun. Like, if you want your first hands-on kill as a murderer.
Do it hands-on.
Do and it with your hands.
But Will pulls the triggers is
it's huge.
It's shocking for him. Mm-hmm. You know, that he's gotten to that point where he's ready to kill this person. And that's when he...
Just
know,
to kill it.
He does
not
that.
Not in defense.
Right,
not
no. Just that you know, this you, man yeah. needs yeah. to die and he's going to be the yeah. vigilante yeah. justice.
It's like, I can feed dealer. The caterpillar.
Well, yeah.
I can whisper through the chrysalis.
But with yeah. all my knowledge and intrusion, I can never fully predict you.
Yes.
Yeah.
It right follows, there, that was an, yeah, I can't
it
quit
follows
you.
Its
well, and that,
own nature.
That's when he's got his hands on his head and neck, yeah. and they're close, and they're leaning in mm. towards each other. This image, this frame, is the frame that launched a thousand splooshes. This is, it's everywhere, and it's all sorts of, Hanagram Memes, which is, by the way, the name for Hanagrams. Hanibal and Will fan fiction. It's Hanagrams. And it's everywhere.
Better than our Hanibalana.
Hanalana.
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 But the I think I actually might Alanable. Have said this.
Alanable? I like that one.
Alanable, yeah. Where we were watching them.
Isn't that what I used to say when when I couldn't figure out Abigail's name in the middle
yeah,
of
the night? Yeah, I think yeah. so. Yes.
And you get that moment where they're so close and you're like,
yes.
now kiss.
Hannibal
now
is
kiss,
what I used
kiss.
To say. Hannibal.
Hannibal. But it's true. He takes Will's face in his hands and that whole thing of it follows its own nature and mm-hmm. it is bigger than me. You know, and their faces are close and yeah. There's a whole lot going on.
There's a lot
there.
Going on, indeed.
Yes. And then that's it. Then we
and
end
then
with
that's it.
Birds chirping.
Yeah, weird credits with birds.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it is relevant.
See, I don't know what kind of bird it was. I wondered if it was a starling.
Oh.
I don't know.
Oh.
And if it wasn't a starling, I hope it was a minor bird.
Laura?
Laura?
Laura? Laura? Leo, no!
I didn't mention at the beginning, this episode was directed by Vincenzo Natali, mm-hmm. who is directing the first three episodes of next season,
oh.
and directed one of my favorite low-budget horror movies, Cube.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Have I seen
I don't know. If you haven't seen Cube,
ooh,
you need to watch
we
it.
We should rewatch
it's
it.
A whole,
cube
it's
one,
a bunch
cube
of people
two.
Just trapped in cubes.
In a cube?
In an evil
really, with
Rubik's
traps
cube.
Everywhere. It's really, really
it's an
awesome.
Evil Rubik's Cube is the way I remember it.
Real low budget, really interesting, okay. interesting film. So, you can, what is that? Is that a starling?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it looks an awful lot like that bird.
It most certainly does.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if it was a starling
yeah.
with all the other Silence of Lambs
yeah. And there's a lot
references.
In this episode.
There is a lot. So, send us an email at eattherootcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @eattherootcast. And check out our Tumblr, eattherootcast.tumblr.com. We are nearing the end of this season.
I can't wait.
We are trying to get there. Because we want to watch all these other things and watch the... deleted scenes and the outtakes
exactly.
and
well you know the difference here it's not like a fan who gets to binge watch all day
no
we watch twice
every yeah. episode of Eat the Rootcast takes about 4 hours of our time to produce
yeah.
That's not including editing 4 hours of active so we can't just go through this season.
No.
As much as we'd like to, we just don't have days that we can watch multiple episodes.
Because we have,
jobs.
Like life and stuff.
I know. What's
yeah.
that about?
And like kids and
bills to pay.
I've got like a husband who actually like wants to see me every once in a while.
And he comes up and he's like, oh, you're watching Hannibal again?
Yeah.
I guess I'll watch it.
I guess I'll watch it. It's the only time we're going to spend together, I guess.
I suppose. So thanks for joining us at the table.
Okay, so Margot and Hannibal.
Yeah, you definitely trailed off there.
Church and Ridger.
Church and Ridger.
And then...
something cackling.
Cracking.
Cracking?
Cracking. You... Yuki cracking?
Yuki okay, so cracking?
It's Margo and Hannibal, and then Tenton Romp, Rap?
I have
Tenton Rap doesn't mean anything. So
UCK cracking.
You're listening to a Swingset podcast at swingset.fm.